Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Power on the move in Washington this week, in the 112th Congress, in the White House, a bad killing in Pakistan, Goldman Sachs hugs Facebook, and a Navy captain out on his ear. In the House, Nancy Pelosi handed off to a new speaker. Listen for the GOP cheer.
I now pass this gavel and the sacred trust that goes with it to the new speaker. God bless you, Speaker Boehner.
Speaker John Boehner said it's down to work time.
Hard work and tough decisions will be required of the 112th Congress. No longer can we fall short. No longer can we kick the can down the road.
And Captain Owen Honors lost his command over raunchy onboard videos that were too blue for the Navy.
This evening, we've got some different chicks in the shower in a clip that was previously too sensitive to show. However, we have protected their identities.
Some different chicks in the shower. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Brian York of the Washington Examiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you see coming from the GOP, from the new White House team, from the economy? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Nancy, Byron, Jack, great to have you all here. Let's listen to a little more John Boehner right at the top. Here he is as Congress, with the new Republican majority in the House, gets down to work.
We gather here today at a time of great challenges. And nearly 1 in 10 of our neighbors is out of work. Health care costs are still rising for American families. Our spending has caught up with us, and our debt soon will eclipse the entire size of our national economy.
And before we forget her speakership, here was Nancy Pelosi as she prepared to hand that gavel off to the incoming Republican Speaker of the House, talking about the accomplishments of the last Congress.
When I was first elected Speaker, I called the House to order on behalf of America's children. And now, as I prepare to hand the gavel over to Speaker Boehner, I know one thing above all else. Thanks to you, we have stood with those children and for their families, for their health, their education, the safety of the air they breathe, the water they drink, and the food they eat.
And she went on to talk about Wall Street reform and making college more affordable and consumer protections and, I guess, health care reform, which she referred to there at least as a patient's bill of rights. Okay, Nancy Cordes, what do you see going on here? Do we have a complete shift of gears in Washington, or are we headed into deadlock?
There's a major shift of gears going on here, Tom. Republicans are very eager to make their mark, to say, we are here and it is a new day. Mm-hmm. And you heard new Speaker Boehner in that speech pledging to be more open. You heard Nancy Pelosi, the outgoing speaker, pledging that she was going to be a willing partner. Those were all very lovely words. But what happened not 10 minutes after they gave those speeches, but Republicans and Democrats started locking horns on the same old issues, starting with health care, and then moving on to financial reform.
Byron York, what do you think the House majority of Republicans can actually accomplish in terms of chipping away at or rolling back the Obama agenda? They're up against a Democratic Senate majority. They're up against a Democrat in the White House. If you've got a checklist, what can really change on that checklist, Byron?
Well, first of all, they will pass a bill to repeal Obamacare, and that's the fate in the Senate seems sealed, although there are a number of senators, Democratic senators, who are up for re-election in 2012 who are very nervous about what they voted for. They might be open to some sort of repeal, but in realistic terms, certainly the president having veto power, that's probably not going to happen.
Right. So what do you think can really happen as we march into these months ahead?
Well, they're planning to do a couple of things. As far as health care is concerned, the Obama health care legislation creates lots of new commissions, boards. There's spending aspects to it that Republicans feel that they can strip away and whittle away at with their spending power in the House. And then the other issue, of course, is federal spending in general, where the president's probably going to be more cooperative than he will be on health care. and they feel that they can make some progress on that, and they're probably right.
Are they going to be able to slow down Wall Street reforms? Is that a good idea economically or politically? What about on the EPA and the environment?
They're not as united on Wall Street reforms. That was not an entirely partisan bill. So in terms, they feel that there was too much regulation in some areas, and they can probably whittle away at that. But that's not like on their agenda, like health care is on their agenda. As far as the EPA is concerned, their big target is the Obama administration's claim that it will unilaterally regulate carbon emissions.
That is the EPA taking up the executive authority that's been confirmed by the Supreme Court, right?
Congress feels that it has. Yeah, but the Supreme Court did not say that Congress couldn't act on this. So Congress feels that they, at least the House Republicans, feel they can take significant action on that front.
So there may be some more stopping things right there. Definitely on health care, here was Eric Cantor, the new House Majority Leader, Republican of Virginia, on CBS's early show yesterday, promising action to push back on health care reform.
Next week, what we'll see on the floor is a bill to repeal the health care bill. And it's important, I think, Erica, to remember, most Americans don't like the health care bill and know that there's a better way. And we have committed to the people that have elected us to begin to work together across partisan lines to try and effect change that will actually improve the lives and deliver results for more Americans.
Most Americans don't like, he says. Of course, battle lines are drawn. And Democrats, we heard Louise Slaughter there earlier, out today saying, 53% like it, 13% wish it was stronger. Jack Beatty, on health care, on the bigger agenda here, whether Republican or Democrat, you know, how much movement do you see now? A stalling out and positioning for 2012? A real rollback by this new House Republican majority? Or something else, Jack?
Not much chance of a rollback for the reasons that Byron said. I thought it was discouraging that Speaker Boehner, in one sentence, "I do not believe that repealing the job-killing health care law will increase the deficit." That one sentence is in contradiction with two sets of facts. One, of course, as everyone pointed out, was that the CBO, which is the neutral scorer, says no. In fact, repealing health care reform would add $230 billion to the deficit over the next decade. Speaker Boehner says nope. That's their opinion. Second, he calls it a job-killing health care bill. Well, I'm looking at summaries of two studies, one from UCLA and one from Harvard, that predict that over the next decade it will add, the health care reform bill, between 250,000 and 400,000 jobs. This mainly by cutting the overall cost of health care and therefore giving employers more money to hire more people. The Republicans consistently have misrepresented this health care bill. PolitiFact last year ranked as, quote, the lie of the year, the claim made insistently by Republicans that this was, quote, a government takeover of health care. And now they begin the new year with one statement, embodying two conflicts with two sets of facts.
Well, let me ask Byron, Nancy, please.
Yeah, I actually asked the speaker about that yesterday. Mm-hmm. I asked him, what do you think what do you think about the message that it sends to your constituents when the number one promise that you have made is to cut spending and to cut the deficit, mm-hmm. and yet the first major legislative action you want to take, according to the CBO, would actually raise the deficit by $230 billion by the year 2021. And his response, which is a time-honored tradition in Washington, is, well, I don't agree with the CBO numbers. And, we've seen it for decades when parties like what the CBO says and they trot out the numbers and say, look, this is the nonpartisan CBO. This is what they say. Our bill is great. And when you don't like it, you trash the numbers. He actually came out with his own report and sort of waved it in front of all of us and said, according to our report, this job-killing health care bill is actually going to cost, I can't remember, $2.4 trillion or something.
Byron,
like that.
What about it? Is the GOP giving itself a pass on deficit building here, or is there a real cause to go at these CBO numbers, these projections?
Well, I will tell you, personally, I have never believed that Obamacare will reduce the deficit, because I do not believe that the Congress will cut more, you know, about $500 billion, half a trillion dollars from Medicare. I just don't believe they're going to do it. Also, early signs from the implementation of Obamacare are not particularly good. There was a projection that hundreds of thousands of people would sign up for these high-risk pools, and I think the Washington Post recently reported that 8,000 people had, and yet it still exceeded cost projections. So I think there's reasonable, real-world evidence to believe that it simply will not cut the deficit. However, there is this CBO score. Mm-hmm. It was done at the request of the Democrats who put the bill together, and based on their assumptions, such as cutting half a trillion dollars out of Medicare. And Democrats are going to keep citing this, but Republicans simply don't believe it. In this case, I think they're right.
Nancy, let's
and
come
one
back.
One more thing.
Yes, please,
and one
Nancy.
More thing. You know, and Republicans are right about this, that Democrats wrote up that bill, and there was a bit of fiscal gimmickry that went into writing up the bill. For example, sort of front-loading all the good things and all the things that you have to pay for come years later. So, of course, when you add that up over 10 years, it looks like the bill is less expensive than it is. And so that's the point that Republicans are making.
And overall, do you see with committee hearings and slicing away at whether it's on regulation or the EPA front challenging that or on health care, do you see real policy change, real sort of reverse gears and get off in a different direction in the next, I don't know, 6 months, a year, Nancy?
Well, I think Republicans would like to see that, but there's, as Byron pointed out, not that much that they can change when they only control the House and not the Senate. However, you know, they're looking ahead 2 years and thinking, hey, maybe we can recapture the Senate. There are so many seats up for grabs. So if we lay the groundwork now and lay out our agenda now, perhaps in 2 years, we will be able to get more done. On the other hand, there is a very real risk if they focus on things like health care too much. You know, we saw in the last election, we polled Americans again and again. They said, our main concern is jobs. We're over health care. We want to move on. So if they focus on health care, just like the Democrats did last time, they could find it that they're in a disconnect with voters.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a big week in the news. Republicans take charge in the House. Big turnover at the White House. Pentagon talks cuts. A big killing in Pakistan. A Navy commander loses his ship. Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS News, congressional correspondent there. Byron York is here, chief political correspondent and columnist for the Washington Examiner, and our own Jack Beatty. The sound of the United States Constitution being read rang out over the floor this week. There's something new. Here's Speaker John Boehner kicking off the reading.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
The general welfare, the blessings of liberty, Democrats stood up to read as well. We'll talk about it. Lee in Providence, Rhode Island. Lee, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd just like to say that I'm 24, mm-hmm. and I'm registered as an independent, which to me means I vote for who I want to vote for when
okay.
I want to vote for them.
Yep.
I'm not party affiliated. And what I see with this newly formed Republican Congress is that there's all this talk about rolling back on health care, and everyone keeps saying, you know, oh, this is what the people want. The people want health care not to be there. Well, speaking for my generation and basically everybody I know in my age bracket, we do want it there. We do want to stay on our parents' health care until we're 26 because most of us need it. Because of this economy, we can't, like I'm just now being able to get on my feet, you know.
But Lee, what do you say when the Republican leadership says, oh, fine, Lee, but you know, if you dig in here, this is just not a good plan. We need to go a different way. Stick with us. What do you say to that?
I say, I mean, I would hear them out, but at the same time, you know, the only thing that I keep hearing is that they don't want to scale it back. They'd rather cancel the whole thing, which I don't agree with. I mean, I don't understand why the two sides can't just work together on this and other issues. You know, people in their 20s are getting sort of sick of it. You know, one side demonizing the other. It's just like, just work together.
Lee, we hear it loud and clear, and I appreciate your call. Nancy, this, I guess, is the Democrats' hope that benefits like these that are already kicking in, like young people being able to stay on their parents' health insurance as long as their parents them have insurance, will create a bulwark against this push to push back on the reforms, Nancy.
And this was absolutely why it was designed this way, to put the things that everybody likes into effect first, because they knew that as soon as this law went into effect that it would be challenged by Republicans, that it might be challenged in the courts. So they were looking to build up some favorable public opinion before the tough medicine really kicked in.
Byron, what about the please work together plea right there? You know, a lot of people feel like the future of the country is on the line. So where does that take us? You know, throw down partisanship or something else?
Well, I think one thing you got from the caller was that if Republicans had a plan, she would hear them out. And the key part of repealing Obamacare is called repeal and replace. And if Republicans were able to handle that deftly, and they were able to address some of the concerns about people, pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps, that kind of stuff, without the coerciveness and sort of blowing up the system for 85% of the people aspect of Obamacare, that would create pressure on some Democrats. Remember, 23 Democrats are up for re-election in the Senate. A number of them are very nervous about their prospects. That could create momentum for actually changing this bill, this law, significantly.
Well, let's go to Robert in Lawrence, South Carolina. Robert, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I watch what's going on, and it's kind of disturbing. It's reminiscent of third world country politics, where the people in power or the new people in power come in and basically systematically undo everything the previous group did, not because it makes sense, not because it's good or bad for the people, just because. And the Republicans are coming in with that attitude. I don't see them having a plan B. I think they just want everything to go back the way it was, which is, if you can afford to stay healthy, great. If not, see you in the grave. There was just a story earlier on NPR about a guy or several people in, I think, that were taken off the transplant list because their state cut the budget.
In Arizona, yeah.
Exactly. And you know what? Cut the budget on coffee and offices.
Robert, you're breaking up on us, but I think we've got it. Jack Beatty, speak to this. I mean, the Republicans are describing the mandate they're coming in with, and of course, they would. I mean, there's a big change in the count in the House. At the same time, you can hear in both these calls a kind of ambivalence out there. You've been looking at a couple of congresspeople right in the maw of this tension, Jack.
Yes, for the Democrats, 19 Democrats voted against Speaker Pelosi, and most of them were blue dogs.
That is just this week.
Just
I mean,
this
she
week,
was never
yes.
going to be House, but there
That's
had to be a
right,
vote anyway. Yeah,
yeah. Right, right. And, the caucus as a whole, because there are so many fewer blue dogs, is going to be more liberal. What will those 19 or others feel at home in this caucus? Take someone like Mike Ross of Arkansas. Arkansas is one of the few states that actually where John McCain actually did better against Barack Obama than George Bush did against John Kerry. It's really tending red. There he is, an anomalous Democrat. Will he stay with the party, or will he get some sort of plum from the Republicans, and will others follow him? And on the Republican side, their dilemma, I think, is pretty well indicated by someone like Scott Garrett. He's the new chair from New Jersey of the Financial Services Subcommittee on Capital Markets. On the one hand, he's a hero of the Tea Party movement. He's a big pusher of the 10th Amendment. Basically, the federal government should get out of the business of doing pretty much everything domestically and leave it to the states. On the other side, as the Center for Public Integrity points out this week, he's a beneficiary of a big bankrolling in campaign funds from Wall Street hedge funders who poured lots of money into the GOP this time because they didn't want to suffer the indignity of having to pay taxes at the same level as their secretaries.
But who, as Byron says, are not necessarily so popular with Tea Party crowd.
Exactly. Now, you have Ellen Miller of the Sunlight Foundation saying no one in America will believe that Representative Garrett can provide impartial oversight of the hedge fund industry after taking these huge amounts of money. Well, what will the Tea Party people think if he's
patently in the pocket of these hedge funders.
Nancy Cordes, who do you see more united in this new chapter we've got opening up here? Republicans with the kind of tensions that may run through there, or Democrats with the kind of tensions Jack's describing?
Well, I think right now Republicans are very united because the things that they're pushing for are things that both mainstream Republicans and this new Tea Party contingent agree upon: repealing health care, cutting spending. And I think, you know, if there's anything that Robert, your caller, can take away to feel a little bit better about what's going on from his point of view, it's that political parties always do this when there's a change in power. They thump their chests and they say that everything that was done before was wrong and that they're going to do it better. So it's right in these early days when Republicans are looking to make a point. They campaigned on repealing health care reform, so they have to go ahead and take steps to do it. They have to satisfy the Tea Party enthusiasts who really swept them into power in some ways, and then things will probably settle down and you won't see, you know, every single day this wholesale push to repeal and remove all trace of everything that was done the past 2 years.
Byron, John Boehner's already been talking about how they have to, everybody has to be adult when it comes to talking about raising the national debt ceiling. Is that a challenge to the kind of Tea Party fever in parts of his party there? Is he already, you know, pushing back against that there?
Well, there is some part of the new Republican caucus that does not want to vote to raise to the debt ceiling.
They March or April, whenever we bump it, yeah.
Yeah, they want to do what Senator Barack Obama did in 2006, which was vote against raising the debt ceiling as a some sort of symbolic vote against out-of-control spending. Now, what's going to happen is the debt ceiling will be raised. Republicans will try to get some sort of leverage on some spending cuts. You have to remember there's pressure on them to pass a raise in the debt ceiling, and there's also pressure on the president to sign one. So that is going to happen, but it's going to be a shorter period that the debt ceiling is extended, and there's going to be the understanding that during that period there will be actual work to try to cut some spending. Now, there is bipartisan consensus, on spending. I mean, you've got federal spending in 2007 was $2.7 trillion, and in 2010 it was $3.7 trillion. That is a trend that cannot continue. Everybody understands that and agrees on that. That is not undoing the work that Democrats did. When we talk about this wholesale undoing of the previous Congress, that's not actually happening. It's not happening in financial reform. It's happening on health care, which is a single enormous bill passed with the barest of partisan majorities. Democrats in the Senate had a 60-vote filibuster-proof majority for 134 days between the swearing-in of Paul Kirk and the swearing-in of Scott Brown, and it took the defection of Arlen Specter to get him to do it. You can't pass something that big and that all-encompassing on straight party lines and expect instant acceptance of it. But that is the only relitigation of the past, I think, that we're really going to see.
Well, you'd hope not to do it that way, but there are big interests at play here. And I don't know, on the climate side and on Wall Street, I'm not sure it's so clear.
Well, they didn't pass large climate legislation. We're talking about
right, but that was the point.
Executive branch, and there's a lot of fights between the Congress and the executive branch at any time.
Jack, I hear you there.
Yeah, you know, I think the Republican adjustment this week, which I think is laudable, that they said, no, we said in the campaign we would cut $100 billion. Well, really, $50 billion would be enough, and that's because the fiscal year had already started. You know, $50 billion. If President Obama meets them midway, that's $25 billion cut. I don't see how, you know, why that isn't workable. I don't know the federal budget, but by gosh, when you've got states like California having to deal with $28 billion deficits, when you've got Texas, when you've got all these states are dealing with the cuts, I don't see on what political grounds the president could say, no, I can't cut $25 billion because, I don't know, we need to stimulate the economy. Mm. I mean, it seems to me there's a deal that they could make there.
Well, let's look down Pennsylvania Avenue at the changing profile there on the Obama team and what that might look like. Here's Press Secretary Robert Gibbs saying on Wednesday that he would step down from his position as White House spokesman. Talked about the ongoing shakeup in President Obama's senior staff.
Having additional voices, having different and fresh perspectives, having those come from, again, folks that haven't necessarily been inside this bubble for 2 years or 4 years or 7 years, that's really important to the process of running an administration, of running a White House, and of governing a country.
Nancy, what do you see coming with Gene Sperling coming in to be the chief White House economic advisor out of the Clinton years, the Clinton team, with the son of the former Chicago mayor, Boss Daley, William Daley coming in, former investment banker, to be chief of staff there, kind of political power player. What is it signaling to you, Nancy, about how the White House is repositioning itself in this new reality?
Well, I think it signals that the White House realizes that it has a big problem with the business community and that it is being viewed as anti-business, and that that is the message that Republicans are pushing every day. You know, they call this law that they want to repeal the job-killing Obama health care law. And that's a message that is really starting to sink in. So they select someone like William Daley, who has great relationships with Wall Street. And you've got the Chamber of Commerce coming out and saying, we think it's a great pick. How often does the Chamber of Commerce agree with anything that the Obama administration
Almost never.
Does? And even Senator Mitch McConnell, another person who's not known to agree with the White House very much, said yesterday, you know, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I always like to say I don't know anyone at the White House who has ever run a lemonade stand. They're all college professors and former elected officials. But this guy has actually been in the private sector, and I think it's a good idea. And that sort of, you know, shook everyone's, you know,
<There's a new
laughs> everyone off their axis for a while. Did he just say he liked something that the White House did?
Well, let's hear from our listeners on that front. Sheila in New York, DePoyster, New York, Chamber of Commerce is saying thumbs up to the new chief of staff in the White House. Sheila, how do you like that?
Well, I'm not particularly impressed by the United States Chamber of Commerce anyway. I think they're more for large businesses. I had a small business, and I know how hard it is, but my small business was me. And me helping to support my family. Chamber of Commerce means nothing to me. But what I will say is I want an explanation of when I hear all these Republican governors, all these conservatives say, we're going to run like a business. What do they mean, like a business? Like the businesses that got us into the financial mess? Like the businesses that court and send lobbyists down there? I can't afford to send a lobbyist and take John Boehner to dinner. Like the for-profit colleges that have to have loans from the government to be a business, ironically, like the new governor of Florida, whose company made a lot of its money by ripping off taxpayer money.
Yeah.
I want to know what kind of business are we talking about, because it's certainly not the American business model that I think they represent or represent me.
Sheila, I appreciate your call. Byron York, what about it? There's a kind of a, you know, that new skepticism. You say run the government like a business. Maybe at one time that sounded pretty good, but it's, as Sheila's pointing out, from several different angles, that's not such a shiny model anymore.
Well, it's that is a boilerplate statement that politicians make, of both parties make, and they simply mean trying to keep its receipts and outlays more in line than the federal government, which can print money, does. They don't say we're going to try to run the government like a corrupt business.
Well, but it's not that simple anymore, right? The way it's heard by voters is like, well, didn't they drive us off a cliff, that business?
Well, that I think Republicans think that's one of the reasons they got elected on November 2nd. As far as the Daley thing is concerned, I think the president, there are two missions in the White House. And the first mission, above all else, is to get reelected. But the subsidiary part of that is protecting Obama's accomplishments. So bringing in someone who is viewed as a centrist and who could make nice with the new Republican majority in the House and more powerful Republican contingent in the Senate is probably Obama's best way to try to protect his accomplishments, which we spent the first half of this show talking about them being under attack. And I think that that is the president's strategy here, you know, protect, protect, protect.
Jack, do you think a kind of Clintonian centrism is a winning formula? Is it available to this president? What about his base?
Well, that's a problem. We saw it acutely in December when he reached the compromise tax cut unemployment insurance extension deal with the Republicans. There was a great howl from his liberal base. And, you know, you don't have to be a liberal to be a little, to look at this Daley appointment somewhat askance. After all, a top executive at J.P. Morgan, second largest bank, Abbott Laboratories on the board of Boeing. What about these companies do business with the government? What about conflict of interest? Interest. I mean, can he be an honest broker about things like this? We don't know.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, thousands of birds dropped dead in Arkansas. Police Captain Eddie Cullum in the town of Beebe said he got a lot of calls from worried residents.
Some of them were a little panicked, thinking it was the end of the world, quoting 2012 prophecies and things like that.
Floodwaters inundate Australia further and deeper than anyone expected.
Everyone was thinking, oh, won't get to my house. Well, those people that said that, it went through them and went through quite badly.
And former disheveled drug abuser Ted Williams, the homeless man with the golden voice, gets pulled off the streets of Columbus, Ohio for a second chance.
I'm going to take two steps to the rear and get on out of here. But in the meantime, in between time, if you're driving on the highways and the byways, or if you're in the street...
Oh, my God, this is just sensational for one. It's numbing for another, overwhelming. I mean, there's so many words that amazing.
Wild story when you see him coming off the streets. Byron York is with us from the Washington Examiner. Nancy Cordes from CBS News and Jack Beatty. Let's hear from our listeners. Marty in West Falls, New York. Marty, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see?
I love your show, and I love NPR. I just wanted you guys to know you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I think most of your callers, it's really kind of ironic that the Republicans are saying that they want to do what the people want. But it seems that most of the callers that you're getting on your phone on this radio show are for the health care.
Well, believe me, Marty, there's a lot of people out there who might call in differently, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, and, it just bothers me that they in the front of this, they put jobs killing health care. You know, the way they go about things, I don't think the American people want to see another 2 years of nothing.
Why is that ridiculous to you, Marty? Why?
Well, because they never talk about the amount of money that we spend for these guys to sit around and argue all day. I mean, can you imagine if you went into work for 2 years and everything you accomplished, someone that came into your radio show tried to just change everything that the radio does?
Job killing. What's going on with your job, Marty? I don't know. Your house, your pay.
Well, I can tell you right now that I'm an ex-auto worker, and I'm a skilled trades. I'm a pipe fitter, plumber, steam fitter, welder, and I was making $35 an hour. I'm presently making $12.63 an hour, but, life goes on. What are you going to do? You got to work with what you got.
Marty, we hear your life goes on unless it doesn't. I mean, you lose health care, you get in trouble, and things are tough. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Cindy in Newton, Massachusetts. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My point is that I am so tired of hearing the Republicans say that they have a mandate now and it's the will of the people when they win one House of Congress, because 2 years ago when the Democrats swept both houses of Congress and the presidency, then all they were doing was blocking and everything and anything and filibustering. And I just don't understand why they're not called on this.
So where was the respect for the mandate then, you're saying, Cindy?
Yes.
Let us pick that up. And I got one more call maybe on that front. Lexington, Kentucky. Sean, thanks, Cindy. Sean, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think I'm definitely in the minority of your callers today. That I actually was calling to respond to the earlier caller who had mentioned that the Republicans are practicing a third world politics by reversing all of these policies.
Okay.
I see that the exact opposite way. That isn't that exactly what the Democrats did when they took over the White House, the House of Representatives, and the Senate a couple years ago, passed massive legislation that affects our entire societal fabric. And now what's happened is we've begun to restore a slight balance of power that our nation was founded on.
Sean, I appreciate your call as well. I thank you very much for it. Nancy Cordes, what about the way these two parties come into power, when they come into power, the kind of, aura around it, the attitude? How do you see that? Is there a difference?
I think there is a slight difference. I think that both parties, the Democrats 2 years ago and the Republicans today, felt that they had a mandate, felt that they had to strike while the iron was hot and move quickly to impose their priorities, because they know that these things, that the pendulum swings both ways. That's why you saw Democrats start with health care 2 years ago, this big, huge, complicated prospect when the economy was falling apart and you know, Republicans were arguing that it was not the time to take up health care, that it was time to, you know, maybe focus on jobs or some other issue. But Democrats knew that they had a narrow window to try to push through this very big priority of theirs, and they knew that they might not have a 60-vote supermajority in the Senate for long, and so they went ahead and did it. And similarly, Republicans know that they have more power and more juice, if you will, right now at the start of their new majority in the House to go ahead and make a statement, and that everyone's watching them. And so they are they too are going to strike while the iron is hot.
Hey, Byron, what about this mandate claim? I mean, there's still a democratically elected Democrat president in the White House. There's a Democratic majority in the Senate. I mean, who's got the mandate here? It's one out of three of those pieces.
Well, I think Republicans have a mandate to be part of the balance of divided government. I mean, there's no doubt about that. The voters voted for divided government in this case. A couple of things. On the idea of the Republicans stopping everything that Democrats did in the last Congress, I mean, after the lame duck session, President Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi all came out to say this is the most productive Congress in generations, if not history. And indeed, they did get a lot done. So the idea that Republicans somehow stopped everything is simply not true. And I'd like to say one thing about this job-killing thing. For the last 2 years, I've talked to a lot of Republican strategists, pollsters. All of their polls were telling them that people were concerned more than anything else about jobs, and that if a day passed and you weren't talking about jobs in the economy, you had wasted that day. They feel that they got elected in part because Democrats, Nancy just alluded to this earlier, spent so much time pushing a national health care bill, which the public believes was being done at the exclusion of jobs. President Obama was always promising to pivot to jobs in the economy. So now that they're in power, Republicans in the House are framing everything in terms of jobs.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Aren't they just using the jobs-killing phrase to kill health care reform? And I'm also curious about this thing that Obama did nothing on the economy. Republicans were all over him for the steps he did take on the economy, the stimulus and a lot more.
I was simply addressing the caller's statement. You hear commonly that Republicans blocked everything in the last Congress, and it's just factually not true. What you're hearing now is Republicans framing everything in terms of jobs, even when it's not totally about jobs. And this whole idea of the job-killing health care law, I asked him, I said, now, are people worried about Obamacare because they think it kills jobs or because they believe it's going to kill their health care coverage, it's going to lead to rationing, and more expensive, and all of that?
Yep.
And they said, well, it's really both, but it's not really both. The job-killing health care law is a misframing of that issue, but they do it because they believe that they were elected to put everything in terms of jobs.
Let's talk about jobs for a second. This new report out today, people were expecting maybe 150,000 new jobs reported in the latest findings today. Instead, it's 103,000. But Nancy, with that below expectation job creation, the unemployment rate's going from 9.8, I guess, down to 9.4, which is a bigger drop than people expected. What do you make of that? Can that only mean that more Americans are dropping out of the effort to find a job?
Well, what the White House is saying is that, you know, this is something like the most growth since 2004, and, you know, that this is a positive sign, and that, you know, that the economy has been picking up jobs month after month. But, you know, clearly Republicans are going to say that it's not enough. And I think what they're hoping to do...
Well,
and I think
no one thinks it's enough, right? 103,000 won't even employ the new folks coming out of school.
Exactly. And I think that, to Byron's point, I think what Republicans are hoping to do, and the reason that they've scheduled this health care vote so soon, they're actually going to vote on it Wednesday, is that they, too, really want to move on to a real job issue, not a sort of manufactured job issue, because they know that that's what Americans care about, and they don't want to be seen to be dwelling on health care for weeks and weeks instead of, you know, focusing on what they say is a top issue.
It's not all in Washington. The state's really getting going this week with their own problems as well. Here's a web comment talking about Paul Krugman's New York Times column, I don't know, maybe today, I guess, saying how Texas is now looking at a really big deficit, expected to run as high as $25 billion over the next couple of years, even though Texas, under Governor Rick Perry, has done everything, Jeff writes, the Republicans believe in. He writes, they have low taxes, they keep cutting them, small union-based public sector, they've cut spending to the bone. Now, he writes, they have the worst health care issues in the nation and one of the worst public school systems. The future is in Texas. Jack Beattie, you've been looking at states a little bit. What do you think about that?
Well, I thought that was a very interesting column, because what he essentially says is Texas is a test case. This is what the Republicans nationally want to do. They say it. They want to cut discretionary spending in education and other things. And they don't want this health care bill, which would give health insurance to 30 million more Americans. So essentially, they want Texas, and they want Texas because they don't want to raise taxes to pay for any of that. And what the result is, of course, you don't get the services, and you do get the deficit. But the states are in just terrible, terrible trouble. I saw Governor Cuomo in New York, Andrew Cuomo's State of the State address, and the whole tone of it was, we have to get very, very serious. Now, how that works, what that's going to mean, effectively what we have is, as people like Krugman have been pointing out now for years, is 50 Herbert Hoovers in these state houses. Because of their constitutions, they have to balance budgets, they have to lay people off, they have to cut spending. All of that is a drag on the economy. All of that is going to be could even be a break on the economy this year. And this year, because of the Republican majority in the House, there'll be no chance for the Democrats to vote aid to the states. It looks like a very, very tough course for state government.
Well, you say Herbert Hoover's, and that the tone of Andrew Cuomo's speech was serious. Of course, he's a Democrat, very, very much so, newly elected Democratic governor in New York State. New York Times, however, called that speech emphatically pro-business. And let's listen to a little bit of it. I mean, it's hard to say otherwise. You really stress the need to stop tax increases.
We have to hold the line on taxes for now and reduce taxes in the future. New York has no future as the tax capital of the nation. Our young people will not stay. Our businesses will not come. This has to change.
Newly elected Democratic governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. Byron, New York, talk about son of Mayor Daley in the White House. Here's son of Mario Cuomo with that message in Albany.
It's astonishing. I mean, look, I do agree with Jack about the states. I think everybody agrees about the states. They are in terrible shape, but particularly New York, Illinois, and especially California. They are in trouble in large part because of astonishing pension liabilities unfunded for their public employees. They are coming to a day of reckoning, and the best they will be able to do is to try to keep the promises that they have made to currently retired employees, but change the promises they have made to presently employed employees. Because if they don't, they are facing total disaster. And we could be looking at a situation in which cities can declare bankruptcy. States have not done it. What would happen? What would the federal government do? It is completely uncharted territory.
Looking for a second chance there. Let's get a call from Lynn, Massachusetts. Joseph, you're on the air, Joseph. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call, and how are you?
Great.
I'm glad to be on. I'm a first-time caller. I want to thank your producer. She's very gracious.
Good.
I want to comment on the homeless man, and I'd like to comment on the health care thing. Okay, the homeless man, I'm thrilled. It's about time more people like him got a chance.
This is the guy all over television this week. He's named Ted Williams, of all things, from the streets of Columbus, Ohio. What the local newspaper saw him there panhandling, I don't know, at an intersection, Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, listen to this guy's voice, and it sounds like something out of Central Radio casting in Hollywood.
Tom, a lot of people have hidden talents. I'm going to be on YouTube, and I hope things get better for me. And now my comments on...
You go, Joe. You go.
I'm serious.
Okay.
I'm serious.
Go.
Guys, someone's going to put me up there, and we're going to do a DVD. Now my comments on health care. First of all, we should take a look at the Japanese. And you had a guy in the New York Post who did a program on PBS, the health care system in Switzerland. We have to get some sort of control in the health care, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. We need services for the handicapped all over the country. Some states have some have don't. We got to stop this bickering and fighting and acting like children.
Who do you trust to produce that for the country, Joseph?
That's a very good question. I really don't know. Independent people, first of all, we got to stop the fraud, get term limits, and then I think that will do it. Because I don't know whether you're willing to have this guy on as a guest. He's the prime minister of the government, not the prime minister, the head of the healthcare system in Japan. And Switzerland, how they can do it, if they can do it, we can do it. We are modernized and industrial country, and we can't take care of our own. We take care of everybody.
Got to do something, Joseph, and I appreciate that. Looking abroad for a second there, we got Japan and Switzerland, but Pakistan really got my attention this week. This assassination of this very prominent governor, close ally of the prime minister there, governor of Punjab province, who had spoken out against Pakistan's blasphemy laws, which are very tough. You say anything against Islam, and formally you can be sentenced to death, was killed, Jack, by his own bodyguard, elite military bodyguard, right in the heart of sort of his constituency there. And the message out to the world, I guess, watch out if you're in Pakistan and want to speak out on this. I've got a little tape of him. It's interesting. This is from the grave at this point. But Salman Taseer, governor of the Punjab province, assassinated Tuesday in Islamabad. His killer, one of his own security guards, was angered by that opposition to harsh blasphemy laws there. He was talking to CNN just last month about his opposition to that law.
Look, the blasphemy law is not a God-made law. You know, it's a man-made law. It was made by General Ziaul-Haq, and the portion about giving a death sentence was put in by Nawaz Sharif. So it's a law which gives an excuse to extremists and reactionaries to target weak people and minorities.
Extremists and reactionaries given power, he said, by this law, and then he's killed by his own military guard. Is that the extremists, Jack, the reactionaries in this nuclear-armed country?
It appears to be, and then you see the penumbra of fear out of this. People publicly saying, well, I'm not going to speak against it. I'll only criticize this assassination anonymously, several people saying. And you know, the man was shot 30 times. The other guards didn't intervene to prevent this. And it's a paradigm, isn't it, of the real ultimate terror that the security forces guarding the nuclear installations could themselves go jihadi.
A reminder that while Washington resets, the rest of the world does not go away, and we will follow it. Byron York at the Washington Examiner, it's so good of you to be with us today, Byron. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, you are terrific, and we appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
Jack, great to have you. Thank you, Nancy. Jack, have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by a whole lot of really great people. Julie Jupp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.